Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Obama's final official overseas trip continues today in Germany. He landed in Berlin last night after a stop in Greece. It's also his final meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who the president has formed a strong relationship with over the years. Earlier today, the two gave a joint press conference. The president spoke about the two countries' history of cooperation and possible challenges for the future.
It is not inevitable that we make progress. It requires hard work. Sometimes it may seem as if progress is stalled, but what the history of post-war Germany shows is that strength and determination and focus and adherence to the values that we care about will result in a better future for our children and our grandchildren.
Chancellor Merkel said she is ready to work with President-elect Donald Trump and also that she valued her time working with President Obama. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
This is the end of an 8-year cooperation that was very close indeed. From a German point of view, German-American and European-American relations are a pillar of our foreign policy.
Well, joining us now from Berlin is Jenny Hill of the BBC. And Jenny, President Obama's trip comes at a time where many people think that he needs to be assuaging fears and concerns of national leaders abroad after the American election. So what are the concerns in Germany?
You're absolutely right. I think behind the scenes in Berlin, there is real consternation about the president-elect and what he might mean for foreign policy and all sorts of other policy too. His election came as a great surprise, of course, and particularly to the government here in Berlin. I know that behind the scenes, politicians and civil servants are desperately going to the phone, sending off emails, trying to make contact with members of Donald Trump's team, because as one of them said to me a couple of days ago, we didn't expect him to win, so actually we didn't make contact with anyone. At the same time, they're, I think, seeking reassurance about Mr. Trump's plans for the future. And you're right, there is a lot of concern here that, for example, Mr. Trump might tear up some of the work that they've achieved together on, say, climate policy, as one example. So there is a lot to talk about. But of course, whilst Mr. Obama and Mrs. Merkel have made it very clear that they want further cooperation, no one really can guarantee that now besides Donald Trump.
We'll get to a little bit more about President Obama and Chancellor Merkel in just a moment. But do we know what she thinks specifically about the president-elect?
Well, we don't, of course. I think that we know that she was hoping that the president who would take over the reins in the White House would be Hillary Clinton, primarily because there was a sense here in Berlin that she would be more of a continuation of the current administration's policy. There is undoubtedly shock and I think horror too. But Mrs. Merkel is a pragmatist. She has sent her congratulations to Donald Trump, although in a rather qualified way. Interestingly, she offered her cooperation, but on the basis that Mr. Trump respects the shared values of freedom, respect of the rule of law, and applies those values, democracy and so on, to everybody, regardless of background, ethnicity, gender, sexuality and so on. So it was a very qualified congratulations. And I think that probably tells you all you need to know about Mrs. Merkel's fears for the future. At the same time, though, she's got to make this relationship work. Germany and the US are very important trading partners, of course, but also they've been very important political allies too. It really matters on an international level that these two countries get on, because of course Germany for so long has in effect been the de facto leader of Europe. And so I think Mrs. Merkel's very aware of that responsibility too.
Well, to that point, both President Obama and Chancellor Merkel published a joint article in defense of globalization. They wrote that, quote, "there will be no return to a world before globalization." However, I mean, the U.S. election and, of course, Brexit as well in the U.K. and the rhetoric of many right-wing parties in Europe speaks to the exact opposite, a strong and passionate pushback against globalization. So tell me a little bit about why Chancellor Merkel felt compelled to write this with President Obama now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read that document, I think, slightly differently in that I think that they were trying to also say this is effectively the toothpaste out of the tube. We can't put globalization back, but we're going to have to deal with it in a coordinated global kind of a way. We're going to have to look at improving the economic lives of people. We're going to have to make sure that values are upheld despite all of this. Chancellor Merkel is only too well aware, I think, of the threat of populism to established parties like hers. There's a general election here in Germany next year. Her party and all the established parties here are under pressure from Germany's Alternative for Deutschland. It's AfD. It's a populist grassroots kind of party, which is very anti-migrant, very anti-Muslim, but it's doing very well. And there are concerns here, in fact, that Donald Trump's victory will fuel more support for that particular party. So she knows she's got to do battle with this, as does the entire government here in Berlin. At the same time, I get the sense that her rather pragmatic view is that globalization is here to stay. It's just a question of how we handle it.
Mm. Well, this is President Obama's final visit to Germany as a sitting U.S. president. Of course, he came back in 2008 as a senator. Some 200,000 people saw him speak in Germany on that visit. I'm wondering how Germans look at him now and what his reception has been in the country this time around.
Yeah, interestingly, what's rather unfortunate is that when Barack Obama came in 2008, people were actually physically able to get to see him. During this two-day visit, and perhaps rather unusually, there have been no real public engagements. There hasn't been anywhere that people can gather to see him. And because of security concerns, the area where he's been staying and moving around has been completely sealed off. So you're not seeing the kind of crowds. But I think it's fair to say that Germany is going to miss Barack Obama. He's thought of so highly here. Germans see him as a very popular figure. I think largely because his rather liberal worldview is very much in tune with certainly Angela Merkel's, but also I think many, many Germans too. And I think now that Germany is looking at the reality of the president-elect Donald Trump, they are certainly viewing Barack Obama's time in the White House with a great sense of fondness. So yes, as I say, I think he will be missed here.
Well, that's the BBC's Jenny Hill speaking to us from Berlin. Jenny, many thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Well, President Obama leaves Germany tomorrow and heads straight to Peru for the Asia-Pacific Economic Conference this weekend. It will be the first time world leaders will gather together since the U.S. election. Donald Trump's victory and its impact on regional trade deals expected to dominate the conversations. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Already one massive free trade deal, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has been thrown into doubt by the U.S. election. The TPP was supposed to stitch together the economies and security arrangements between the U.S. and 11 Pacific Rim countries, from Singapore to Australia to Chile. But the TPP fell victim to a wave of opposition to globalization during the U.S. presidential campaign.
I think if it's not dead yet, someone is already off measuring the size of the coffin to put it in.
Scott Kennedy is an Asia specialist at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says congressional leaders have made it clear they won't consider the TPP during the lame duck session. And Kennedy says it's unlikely to be revived in a Trump administration.
He is extremely dissatisfied with the trade arrangements that currently exist, feel the U.S. isn't being treated fairly. So one question will be, well, if not TPP, then what?
Kennedy says China could step in and create a similar trade agreement, reducing U.S. influence in the region. Or the other 11 countries in the TPP could go back to the drawing board.
Change a little bit of the implementing rules and finalize it amongst themselves, leaving the U.S. on the outside looking in, which is definitely not what the U.S. envisioned at the beginning of the process.
The TPP was central to the Obama administration's so-called rebalancing or pivot to Asia, a dynamic region with fast-growing economies. The pivot was meant to help shore up American influence there and act as a counterweight to a rising China. Susan Smith, with the Council on Foreign Relations, says it's unclear how Trump will approach Asia, but it's unlikely his administration will use the words pivot or rebalance.
Clearly, we're not going to hear those two words because I think he has a very different definition of how he wants to use American power in the Asia Pacific as well as around the globe.
Smith says Trump has made it clear he is no fan of multilateralism.
My inclination you know, he wants to leverage American negotiating position. You can hear that in how he discusses alliances, and you can hear it in how he talks about trade deals. So I think by instinct, he is going to be a bilateral, somebody who emphasizes bilateral negotiations.
Rather than negotiating a sweeping trade deal like the TPP. Harry Kazianis with the Center for the National Interest says engaging with Asia makes a lot of sense, but a Trump administration would approach it much differently. Kazianis says it would have a more robust military aspect.
What the Obama administration did was it was a much more economically focused pivot. I think what a Trump administration tries to do is its overarching strategy will be towards China to restrain Chinese actions, to try and halt Beijing from changing the status quo unilaterally.
But already, longtime allies are opening up to Beijing. Malaysia signed defense and energy agreements with China, and the Philippines recently was given a $9 billion infrastructure deal. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
And it's time for audience participation, because Thanksgiving is coming and we are looking for your side dishes. We know many will include marshmallows, but we want to know, what are you serving on the side? Send us your recipes in the comment section of this segment at hearnow.org or on our Facebook page. Meantime, Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst has been checking in with her foodie friends across the country. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Robin.
And side dishes, to me, are
the everything. I mean, the turkey, I love turkey, but it's true. I mean, what you serve on the side of your turkey distinguishes very often who you are, where you came from, what kind of childhood you had.
How many marshmallows,
how many siblings, how many great aunts, how many uncles, how long did they last? But I thought it would be fun to reach out to some food friends across the country and get some regional side dishes. Mm-hmm. So we're going to start in the West, and that is the salad. Jessica Badalana is a San Francisco-based food writer. Her first solo cookbook is called Repertoire, and it'll be out in 2017. Mm-hmm. This is her very, very beautiful salad filled with fresh colors. It's so California.
Yeah, let's describe. There's just so many items in here. Start with the lettuce.
Well, it's not regular lettuce. This is called a chicory salad. Chicory in the wintertime, there's so many different types. You've got the beautiful purple-tinged radicchio. We've got frise, the curly leaf, and escarole, which you know maybe from Italian restaurants where they braise it, or escarole soup. But escarole's delicious eaten raw. So you just kind of coarsely chop those three different types of chicory. And then there's blue cheese, adding a creamy element, toasted walnuts. Mm. Now, the two California fruits, the orange slices, those beautiful, beautiful slices, those are persimmons. In season now. They will be on many Western Thanksgiving tables.
Okay, let's hold up a second here with the persimmon, which is stunning. It looks like a slice of a big carrot.
Yeah, but you see the star pattern in the middle? They're so beautiful.
And so do you just slice it?
Yeah, it's the raw fruit. You peel off the outside, you take off the stem, and you just slice it. And what I love about them is they're not particularly sweet. There's two types of persimmons that grow on the West Coast. There's fuyu and hachaya. Hachaya are too astringent to eat unless they're really mushy, and they're used in a lot of puddings and baked goods. But the fuyu are sweet and slightly firm, but not too sweet. And I love it with the blue cheese and the nuts.
I was just going to say, with the blue cheese, what a combination.
So good. And then, of course, pomegranate seeds. Everyone knows pomegranate juice, but you cut a fresh pomegranate and you squeeze it, and the beautiful, beautiful maroon-colored seeds. And that gives it a great crunchy texture. So you have this chicory, which is slightly bitter and crunchy, and it's a little bit sweet with the meaty walnuts, the persimmons, and the pomegranates. I would like that on my table every year.
You know, it's like a West Coast Waldorf salad.
Kind of,
raisins and things and blue cheese on it. This has got...
And you can find persimmons and pomegranates across the country. Mm. So bring a little West to your table.
Okay.
Thank you, Jessica.
Move on.
Okay, the potato salad in that earthenware. Mm-hmm. My very dear old friend Karen Frillman, her mother, Edna Frillman, has made this warm potato. She calls it a salad, but it's not really, with bacon. I know you don't eat bacon, so I made half of it without.
Thank you.
Edna grew up in a parsonage near Forestville, Michigan, and she got this recipe from her mother-in-law, Laura Frillman, from Melrose Park, Illinois. And apparently, there were a lot of potluck dinners centered around church activities, and the Frillmans made, her mother Edna made this potato salad with bacon at many, many church suppers, and it would proudly sit among the Jell-O molds and casseroles.
And things with marshmallow.
Yes.
Okay. Now, we taught, this is, well, we're going to have all these recipes at herenow.org, and hopefully some of yours that you're sending in, but this is wonderful. And it does make me feel like I'm at a church supper. We talked a bit ago about sweet potatoes, and we'll have those recipes too. You can link to them because they're great. But you've brought us yet another sample.
I did. This is a really wonderful dish. This is from Nancy McDermott, a food writer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She's the author of Southern Soups and Stews. So before I talk about this dish, we didn't get to mention this last time. The difference, even though these are called candied yams, they're actually sweet potatoes. So I thought just quickly I would tell you that a sweet potato is a root vegetable. It's orange in color. There's a lot of variations in color, but it's a long red skinned root vegetable, and it's actually in the morning glory family, which is so interesting. But a yam is from Africa, Southeast Asia, or the Caribbean. It's white fleshed, it's got a rough dark skin, and it's very starchy and dry, and almost always when you're eating something called a yam, it's really a sweet potato.
Well, and we got comments from our listeners in the South saying thank you for not calling your sweet potatoes yams, because they are different.
Exactly. And apparently North Carolina is where more than half of the United States sweet potatoes grow, and it is the official state vegetable since 1995, Nancy McDermott tells me. So these candied yams have but three ingredients, and you can probably guess at least two of them, or all of them, by tasting it. Butter, sugar, and sweet potatoes. But her technique is so wonderful. You boil them a little bit, not till they're cooked, but just a little pre-cooked. Then the skin peels right off. You slice it. You smother it in sugar. I added less than she called for, and it's still
it's
fabulously
so
sweet, right? You can add as much or as little as you want. And then the butter. And then I actually let it sit overnight and just baked it now. And what a great addition to a Thanksgiving table, a little bit of Southern sweetness.
Could you use brown sugar?
Yeah, absolutely you could use brown sugar. She said people use maple syrup, cane syrup, brown sugar, palm sugar, but granulated sugar is her tradition, and it's very easy to scatter over the sweet potatoes, but brown sugar would be delicious.
Okay. Well, and always, Kathy, we want to have some of your cranberry sauce.
Kind of a tradition, isn't it?
It sort of is, yes.
So from the East Coast, let's hear it for the East Coast, where cranberries grow in bogs and Cape Cod. They grow in many parts of the country, but I do think of it as a Cape Cod kind of treat. Mm-hmm. My cranberry sauce does not change much year after year, because if it did change, I would be yelled at by my family. It's got fresh ginger, it's got fresh pineapple chunks, maple syrup, and then at the end you add some toasted chopped pecans to give it that nutty, meaty flavor. And my dad, who I miss so much, every year wanted the canned cranberry sauce, no matter how good mine was.
Well, that's the final thought for the cook. Don't take it personally. There are people that get locked into taste. If your dad wanted the canned,
exactly,
you just go. Or somebody wants marshmallows in something.
They're gonna want them.
You just
go. You could throw those on Nancy's sweet potatoes in a minute. But what I find exciting about these four recipes, you hear people say that the United States has become very homogenous in terms of its food, that food's the same whether you're in Chicago or New Orleans or New York, but it's not. We do still have these regional traditions, and I think on the Thanksgiving table, you might see it more than the rest of the year. So I say, here's to regional cooking and honoring our traditions.
Well, and let us hear yours, again, at herenow.org or on our Facebook page, already conversation going there. Kathy, thanks as always.
Oh, thanks, Robin, and have a great holiday.
You too. So, turkey sides. And staying with birds, across this country, Americans on both sides of the aisle are absorbing the results of the 2016 presidential election. But our neighbors to the north have just experienced a stunning electoral upset of their own. After a grueling two-year campaign, a new victor emerged last night in Canada.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm referring to the gray jay, which has been named Canada's national bird by the Royal Canadian Geographic Society, beating out the loon, the snowy owl, both of whom are heavily featured on Canadian gift shop mugs, and Canadian geese, all of whom seem to have moved south. But anywho, here's where we come to Canada's version of the Electoral College. The loon and snowy owl did win the popular vote of nearly 50,000 online votes cast, but the gray jay, also known as the whiskey jack, stunningly came out on top after much debate by the public and a panel of experts. Here's ornithologist and McGill University Emeritus Professor Dr. David Bird, no relation, of course, on The Choice.
Well, the reason this bird snuck in, I assembled a team of ornithologists and birdwatchers from coast to coast, and we called ourselves Team Grey Jay, and we really campaigned hard to get people to vote for this bird. The reason that it snuck in is because the common loon is already Ontario's bird, and the snowy owl, which was in second place, is Quebec's bird. And so I think it was appropriate to pick something fresh and new. I mean, when we picked the flag for our country, we didn't elevate the flag of Ontario or the flag of Quebec to become our national flag. We chose something fresh and new, and that's what we're doing here at the Grey Jay. So I sort of divided and conquered.
Well, but tell us about the bird. We only know that our colleague, who's from Canada, says it will eat sandwiches when you're hiking. This is what we know about the Grey Jay. So let us know more.
The neat thing about the gray jay is that it's an extremely hardy bird. It does not migrate south like a lot of other birds, including the loon. It stays in Canada year-round. Its range almost mirrors that of all of our country's borders, and it's found in every province and every territory. But it's an extremely hardy bird. It breeds at temperatures as low as minus 30 degrees centigrade. Mm. And secondly, it's a very, very friendly bird, as you said, coming down to people's hands at picnic centers and ski trails and so on. And it's also extremely smart, being a member of the corvid or crow family, smartest birds on the planet. So you've got hardy, you've got friendly, and you've got smart, and that to me epitomizes the average Canadian.
That's a bumper sticker right there.
I think so, yeah.
Well, Dr. David Bird, congratulations. We know that the government has to endorse the pick for the national bird, and everybody's hoping that this can happen by your country's 150th anniversary next year. Congratulations on your winning campaign. And I can't believe we're talking to Dr. Bird about a bird, but there you have it. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I really appreciate you calling.
Democrats are debating who should lead them in the House of Representatives starting next year. But we do know one thing. Whomever they pick, Democrats on Capitol Hill will be working from a point of strategic weakness. Because, after all, starting next year, Republicans control the presidency and both houses of Congress. So how do you negotiate when your side of the table has less power? Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review, and he joins us now with some answers to this. Hi there, Kurt.
Hey, Meghna.
So, Kurt, Deepak Malhotra, a Harvard Business School professor, has written about this, negotiating from a point of weakness.
Yeah.
Click through some of his main points.
Yeah. So a lot of people make this mistake where you feel like if you're not needed, then you really can't help. You give up or you become really obstinate. And he says, look, you have to know your weakness, but the other side also has a weakness, and if you focus on theirs, you can actually do better. You can also help shape the narrative. So the Democrats talking about winning the popular vote actually is a way of communicating that they have a lot more political support and a lot more clout than they maybe feel like they have in Congress. And I think a key point is that if you can create value, you have leverage. So Republicans may not need Democrats, but if Democrats can help them, then they have leverage over these issues.
Okay, so on that point, there are some issues where any president, including President-elect Trump, would need support from the other party. What are those and how can Democrats actually leverage them?
Yeah, so trade is the best example, I think, because traditionally the Republican position has been free trade. And Donald Trump lines up more closely to the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party with many Democrats in the Senate, like Elizabeth Warren. You could imagine those two as strange bedfellows on this trade issue. And so if Democrats can work with President Trump on trade issues that he may have a hard time getting all of the Republicans on his side with, then they have some leverage, some negotiating power, some way to compromise with the president on other issues.
Oh, interesting. Now, what about issues where they're, you know, the parties are just poles apart? I'm thinking climate change being one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked a little bit earlier about being obstinate, maybe not necessarily a great negotiating tactic, but what about on this issue?
Yeah, you do have to choose your battles. And so there are some things where Democrats feel like they can't make the issue much better by trying to shape it. They may just want to not participate, save their political clout for battles that they can actually make a difference on. And so there are some of these things that they're just going to have to use as a rallying cry for the midterm elections.
Okay, well, to that point then, what issues do you think fall into the category where Democrats should really continue to dig in their heels? I mean, and also, what does Malhotra have to say about that? There's been a lot of talk about Supreme Court nominations, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they do have the power of the filibuster in the Senate, right? But you better, if you cry wolf, it better be a wolf. So if, he says if Donald Trump nominates an extremist or an unqualified justice, that's a time to really dig in your heels. But on other things like Obamacare, where Donald Trump has already started backing off from his campaign rhetoric of repealing it altogether, Democrats have a big interest in sort of shaping this legacy of President Obama. And it's such a complex issue. They do have a chance to have a seat at the table on that.
Well, that's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Kurt, it's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You got it. My pleasure.
During his campaign, Donald Trump raised the prospect of banning Muslims from entering the U.S. Here's how he justified it on ABC's Good Morning America last December.
What I'm doing is no different than what FDR. FDR's solution for Germans, Italians, Japanese, many years ago.
So you're for internment camps?
This is a president who was highly respected by all. He did the same thing. If you look at what he was doing, it was far worse.
It caused a firestorm, and Trump began talking about a registry of Muslims. Then this week, Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, who's on Trump's transition team, told Reuters that Trump advisors were considering a registry, but of immigrants and visitors from predominantly Muslim countries. And last night on Fox News, Trump supporter Carl Higbee, co-chair of the Super PAC Great America, circled back to Trump's original campaign language to defend that registry idea. Here's Higbee with Megyn Kelly.
To be perfectly honest, it is legal. They say it'll hold constitutional muster. I know the ACLU is going to challenge it, but I think it'll pass. And we've done it with Iran back a while ago. We did it during World War II with Japanese, which, call it what you
Come
will.
On.
Maybe
you're
wrong.
You're not proposing we go back to the days of internment camps, I hope.
No. I'm not proposing that at all, Megan. But what I am
saying
is
that
we need to protect
America.
I mean,
that's the kind of stuff that gets people scared, Carl.
Right. But I'm just saying there is precedent for it.
Well, is he right? Dahlia Lithwick covers courts and the law for Slate. She joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Robin.
So let's parse all of this. You hear Carl Higbee citing the U.S. internment of Japanese during World War II as precedent for registering Muslims. Is it legal precedent?
Well, Carl Higbee is in fact correct that the 1944 Korematsu decision, which split the court 6-3, but in fact upheld the conviction of somebody who had challenged his internment, is still technically good law. Now, it is widely regarded as the lowest moment for civil liberties, up there with Dred Scott, mm-hmm. said Antonin Scalia, in terms of our most shameful decisions.
Let's just back up there. This is Antonin Scalia, the late Antonin Scalia, one of the most conservative members of the court. He thought that this internment was one of America's lowest moments.
Yes. Congress has reported that it was actually overruled by the court of history. Presidents have apologized to the internees in the camps. And yet still it stands as good law. And I would say, Robin, the principle that's enshrined in Korematsu, which is that the president has vast powers over immigration, particularly when they're national security issues, that principle, even though we all agree Korematsu was a disaster, that principle is still very much upheld by the courts. And so I think you can worry a little bit that this is not just an outlier opinion. It's of a long line of views that when the president says he's doing it for national security, the courts step back.
Well, and we should say Donald Trump's advisors, according to Kris Kobach, a Kansas Secretary of State who's on the transition team, are talking about a registry of immigrants and visitors from Muslim countries. They're talking about a registry, not an internment camp. But remind us how that internment camp came to be. This was President Franklin D. Roosevelt. He signed Executive Order 1066, FDR, authorizing this.
That's right. I think there was just a general panic and a feeling that, and it was a feeling that was very much fed inside the White House and inside the military, that Japanese nationals in the United States were cooperating with the Japanese military to undermine U.S. security. And so they went ahead and created, you know, loyalty oaths and this mass internment that literally left Japanese American families. They had to abandon their homes and their property and go register at camps. And I think that it's technically true what Chris Kobach is saying. We are not talking about interning nationals. What he's talking about is a program that was existing during the Bush administration, and it was defunct in 2011. President Obama shut it down. But there is a program for registering non-citizens who are here on all sorts of visas, particularly tourist visas and travel visas, only from Muslim-majority countries. And so we do have a sort of apparatus to do that. And while it doesn't look like internment camps, the principle is the same.
You said a couple of things. So a Supreme Court case decided that FDR's executive order allowing internment camps because of fears of security, that that was legal and that law stands. But then you're saying that what Donald Trump's advisors are talking about looks more like George W. Bush's program, NSEERS, that's National Security Entry Exit Registration System. Tell us more about that. This was post 9/11.
Right. And this is incredibly important because I think Chris Kobach is explicitly referencing this program. And what he's saying is, look, this is not Japanese internment. This is a program that existed and was actually in effect. Most people didn't know about it, but that the point of this program was to take certain groups. I think that there were 25 countries, so this doesn't target Muslim. It just so happens that 24 of the 25 countries on the list were Muslim-majority countries. And then you would have these people who are here on non-immigrant visas have to check in. They would be interrogated. They would be fingerprinted. And I should add that while a lot of these people were swept up and deported as a result of this program, Robin, it was for trivial immigration infractions, not for terrorist activities. And one of the reasons that the program went defunct in 2011 wasn't simply because we didn't need it anymore, but it was considered repetitive, it was expensive, and it achieved none of the aims in terms of fighting terrorism that it was purported to be doing. And now we're holding it up as the model of something we could constitutionally do.
And again, this program was from 2002 to 2011. And if I'm hearing this correctly, this would have been for immigrants to this country. It would not have detected any of the American-born terrorist attackers on this country in the last several years.
That's right. It was a way of tracking new immigrants who are visiting. As you'll recall, one of the things that Trump campaigned on is that we are not vetting correctly all these refugees we're taking in from Syria. And so this is what he's calling a vetting program. One other thing that really bears saying, Robin, is that this program has been challenged and it's been found to be constitutionally permissible. Again, on this principle we talked about at the beginning, which is on these sorts of issues of immigration and national security, the courts give broad latitude to the president when he says something is going to protect national security.
So permissible, legal, because of several court rulings, both with the FDR decision and more recently with George W. Bush's program. And I can hear Trump supporters saying, finally, you know, we will do the thing that makes them feel safe. We hear that. But there's also a whiff for other people of what? Of, you know, where are your papers? And Jews registering in Nazi Germany.
I think that's right, Robin, and I think that's why a lot of groups are incredibly alarmed. You're hearing leadership in the ACLU and Muslim American groups and other groups saying, if there's going to be a registry, sign me up first. I want to be on that registry as well. And I would just tell listeners, it's worth going back and reading the dissents in that Korematsu decision from 1944, where the dissenting justices in really prescient ways warn that it is profoundly un-American to start to judge people based on race or religion or country of origin. We don't do that in this country. We judge people based on their individual actions.
Well, another question would be which countries? Because would France and Britain be having to, anyone who came from those countries have to register because there have been so many attacks in those countries?
Well, as I've suggested, the program that existed in the Bush era had 25 countries, 24 of them were majority Muslim country, and only one was not. So I think that what you're going to see is versions of that continue, although you're quite right, this doesn't sweep in potential terrorists from all sorts of European countries. I think it's also important to reflect, Robin, on the fact that this is a way of getting around a religious test, which Trump originally proposed, right? He wanted to register just Muslims. You can say that's clearly unconstitutional. It is not unconstitutional to do this based on country of origin if you presuppose that that country of origin is dangerous. And so that's kind of the pivot here, is that instead of saying we're going to do this to all Muslims, you just do it based on countries that you deem to be security threats.
That's Dahlia Lithwick, who covers courts and the law for Slate. Dahlia, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, Dahlia said Justice Scalia once said the decision to allow internment was as bad as the Dred Scott decision. That was the 1857 ruling that a slave could not sue for his freedom or have any rights.
The Ohio River runs nearly 1,000 miles through 6 states, and farm waste, such as cow manure and fertilizer runoff, is a major source of pollution in the river's watershed. As Julie Grant of Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports, one group thinks it can or has an answer to control it.
Come on, girls!
There are about 55 cows and 10 pigs on Kenny Merrick's farm in eastern Ohio. The farm sits on a hillside above a creek, which leads to a tributary of the Ohio River.
I grew up next door milking cows at my grandma's place when I got out of college and bought the farm and started farming shortly thereafter.
Today, they raise grass-fed beef and pasture-raised pork directly to customers. They feed the animals and pile their manure at a barn at the top of the hill. It's a muddy hill.
And this was literally, at times, almost waist-deep mud in spots.
The manure and mud used to wash down the hill, mucking up the stream, and Merrick didn't like it.
I needed to change something because we were losing the manure. Would wash off every time it rained. We didn't have a way of containing it, and we didn't have enough space for the cows.
This is just one of some 250,000 farms in the Ohio River watershed, and runoff from many of those farms creates a serious pollution problem. The Ohio is part of the larger Mississippi River Basin, and farm runoff from the Mississippi contributes the majority of nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, responsible for the dead zone, low oxygen areas which kill animal life in the Gulf of Mexico. And there's not much to stop it. Agricultural runoff is largely unregulated. Merrick wanted to stop it on his farm. He planned to lay a large concrete slab for the cows and manure at the top of the hill, secure the hillside, and fence the cattle away from the stream. The price tag, $20,000.
That's enormous costs.
But Merrick heard about something called a water credit trading program. That's where industrial polluters, like power plants, buy credits to meet their pollution limits. Credits cost $10 for a pound of pollution discharged, and the money goes to farmers to pay for projects like his. Jessica Fox is an environmental scientist with EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, which runs the Ohio River Basin Trading Project.
We started looking into it to try to test out if water quality trading could be an effective mechanism to protect America's waters and to meet company bottom lines.
In other words, it might be more cost-effective for industries to pay for farm projects that clean up nitrogen and phosphorus pollution in a waterway than it would be to control an equal amount of pollution at their industrial plants. That's one reason water trading credit programs have been popping up around the country. Fox has worked for more than a decade on this water pollution marketplace between Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, the first multi-state program in the country.
The first thing outright is that there's rigorous science and verification to say that nutrient reductions that we claim we are achieving and turning into credits is real and valid.
But some say water trading programs are pay-to-pollute schemes. Scott Edwards is a director with the advocacy group Food and Water Watch.
We're trading accountability for unaccountability.
His group investigated water trading credits in the Ohio River and the Chesapeake Bay. He says these programs have made it impossible to track exact pollution loads from power plants.
A power plant has to measure its discharges at the end of the pipe, report those results. I can tell you, or I used to be able to tell you, exactly how much pollution was coming out of a power plant and into a stream.
But Edward says there's no way to test exactly how much pollution is being reduced by a manure pad or buffer strip on a farm.
That's a guess of what that buffer could do. No one ever is going to measure whether those 1,000 pounds ever were stopped at that farm from entering into a waterway. There's no monitoring going on.
Environmental regulators in New York rejected a water credit trading program in their state for similar reasons, the difficulty of verifying results on farms. But Jessica Fox at the Ohio River Project says they use well-established modeling to estimate pollution reduction on farms, and they work with state regulators to verify annually the projects are being maintained.
I go out there, I go in the farm field, I can see the projects where there used to be all kinds of sediment and manure running right into the river. There is no question that nutrient recovery is happening.
She acknowledges that they can't exactly measure pollution reduction on a farm the way they can at the end of a pipe, but she says that doesn't mean there aren't as many benefits. Take Ohio beef producer Ken Merrick. Since controlling the mud from his farm, he's seen the stream come back to life.
My wife is actually catching fish out here last summer with the kids. My grandpa used to do that. I never caught anything. It's kind of cool to see the fish coming back into the area.
This is one of 30 farms that have benefited from the water trading program. Project scientists say they've prevented more than 100,000 pounds of nitrogen and phosphorus from getting into the Ohio River. And they have a new round of funding available, this time for forestry projects like tree plantings. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant in Ohio.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.